The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Cardiac Risk Factors and Non-Invasive Cardiac Diagnosis is presented by Dr. Martin Burke.
All right, closer to lunch. Cardiac risk factors and non-invasive cardiac diagnosis. I think when you look at the multitude of tests that are within the cardiac armamentarium, you might come away with the concept that there isn't a test that a cardiologist doesn't love. But let's see if we can put this into perspective for you taking the internal medicine examination. The most important thing to understand about any cardiac testing is that its result is not a definitive conclusion. There's a sensitivity and a specificity to every test that you do, and you need to take into account not just the positives, but the false positives, not just the negatives, but the false negatives. Okay, so hopefully at the end of this, you'll have a better understanding where that lies with different populations and with different tests. I can tell you that EKG is the most sensitive test, but it's the least specific. That's why when you have ST changes or T wave changes, it's not always ischemia. There's at least 25 different reasons why you can have that. You have to take that into account, and that's why most of the examinations are focused on history, physical, so symptoms, some physical findings, and then to test your knowledge of how to take objective testing to a subjective symptom and a subjective physical finding. So you only want to use tests to confirm and or to advance your understanding of what your working diagnosis always is. It's not a shotgun effect. It's something that you have to be somewhat focused on. Now, there are some general tests that are pretty non-toxic and reveal a lot, and that would be the chest X-ray and the echocardiogram. So I always say when you're evaluating a patient with cardiovascular disease, the first five things are history, physical, an EKG, a chest X-ray, and selected laboratory. And that selected laboratory is either a troponin, a BMP, and a CBC, and not necessarily an acute finding for lipid profile, but that could be part of it as well. I usually go over this. This is usually the first lecture, so I go over this as in terms of the guidelines, but we've already done that. So when you're looking at risk stratification, you really have to take into account risk. And so when you look at this particular slide, which is an older slide, but it definitely is a great bar graph slide to indicate that everybody's at risk. So there isn't a single bit of the population that's not at risk for sudden cardiac death every year. You have a 0.1%, if in the most normal status, take into account no other comorbidities, no diabetes, no hypertension, nothing other than just alive, you have a risk of death. And it's 0.1% per year, so when you're by the time you're in your eighth and ninth decade, you have an 8 to 9% chance of dying without any other cardiac condition and or risk factor. So then when you look at what we've done over the last 35 years in cardiology, is we've tried to look at the risk-benefit ratio of certain interventions. In this particular case, in the lower part, ICDs versus medical therapy to prevent sudden cardiac death. And it's important to understand these dynamics because this gives you a better understanding of the risk-benefit ratio of doing objective testing. So when you're looking at What we've come up with over all these randomized clinical trials is if you've died once, the likelihood of you dying again is very high. And so you need to apply risk factor modification with the defibrillator to those patients. But what this slide shows you is that that's the lesser bit of the population every year. And that most of the objective testing I'm going to talk about really involves that circle above where they aren't identified yet. And there isn't a big trajectory as to what day or what kind of a cause is going to have them not survive. Because really, the most important thing to a patient in your clinic is not so much outside of how they're feeling. It's, am I going to die? They don't want to die. It's a sort of a basic biologic premise of survival. So what you're doing is trying to understand better how can you predict and or understand their cardiac disease profile and risk profile. But I want everybody to understand in this room that everybody is at risk, regardless of any other additive profile features. Now, if you had an acute coronary syndrome, which you just heard about, your risk is much higher. And so you have to have a much more advanced understanding of where you're going to objectively evaluate this patient in order to get them over this acute coronary syndrome process. And this is actually a good slide from the Valiant study, which demonstrates that ejection fraction has a pretty good predictive value in understanding where the patient's going to fall out over that first 6 months. Once you get past that 6 months, you see how everything sort of comes down to normal. And so this gives you a general idea that you're going to be much more attentive and trying to understand. And a lot of what Dr. Bender just talked about is in that realm. So, you know, it's very important in the risk stratification process to do some imaging after their acute infarct to better understand where they fall on this risk profile. And so sudden cardiac death after an acute MI is not always arrhythmic. It is sometimes hemodynamic. It's from rupture. You get VSDs. You get pseudoaneurysms and things of this nature, which can go undiagnosed post-MI unless you do imaging. And so that's a point in the first 6 months is the critical part to evaluate that. So this is taken out of a circulation paper by Ron Blankstein, who's an imaging expert at the Brigham. He essentially did a good job, I think, in just detailing some of the imaging data and modalities that are available to you today to assess these risks that I'm talking about. So Dr. Bender talked about the acute coronary syndrome, so I'm going to move forward out of that area and talk more about non-invasive testing in the process of risk stratification. But I think it's very important as practitioners to understand that everybody's at risk. And what you're trying to do is to hone in on those low percentage patients and try to figure out who's going to possibly be at more risk this year than they were the previous year. All right, so exercise treadmill testing is great to understand two specific things. Number one, what is your heart rate response to exercise, and what is your blood pressure response to exercise? You can sometimes find higher blood pressure in some labile patients when you put them on a treadmill. And so that's a feature that's very important, as I told you, with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, and then obviously any cardiomyopathy. Echocardiogram is the gold standard first evaluator. It's part of the first five evaluation. And then you get into the secondary five evaluations. So after you move through the first evaluations of myocardial status with history, physical, chest x-ray, EKG, and echo, you move on to more three-dimensional type imaging with CT, nuclear imaging, and cardiac MRI. Furthermore, you can add to that angiography and invasive hemodynamic monitoring. So I always like to put perspective through cases. So this is a 50-year-old male, no prior history other than hypercholesterolemia. He was on a statin at the time. He had palpitations and near syncope while he was driving his truck going from one job to the next. He was in the ER, and during his ER visits, had some spontaneous wide complex tachycardia that stopped on its own. Pertinent history, though, is that his father had sudden death at age 55, which they were told was a heart attack, you know, the general heart attack comment, which doesn't make any delineation whatsoever. So they just thought that he had a blockage of the artery and he died suddenly at 55, which is not a, you know, that could happen. But now that we have this information, very important. His exam is unremarkable. His EKG. All right, so take a little time to review this. And this is, you know, technically how a board exam, you know, might be presented to you, or a question. And so you're going to get an EKG like this. And so this EKG was read in the ER as normal. It is not normal. This EKG is abnormal. And the EKG is abnormal across the anterior precordium. You see that there's a loss of R wave projection across the anterior. Now, in somebody that's just having an EKG, the screen without the presentation that I just gave you, you know, you're not going to make a big deal about this. I'm not going to get on the phone to the doctor and say, hey, look, man, this EKG is bad. You got to do something right away. But what did I tell you in the first part? The EKG is the most sensitive screening test you're going to do. So it is abnormal. So that means what? You need to do more objective testing to look into this. Okay. Most people aren't going to get, and the other thing here is the left axis deviation is not normal. This is just an example of the ventricular tachycardia the gentleman had. I just blew it up into a slower paper speed than a 12-lead ECG. But what you see here is that it's a right bundle branch block morphology that has isoelectric lead 1. So it's in the septum. When you look at the EKG, the abnormality is across the anterior precordium. The septum. So this is coming together a little bit as an abnormality. He underwent an electrocardiogram that was abnormal that I showed you. The chest x-ray was normal. The echocardiogram was normal. And he had a stress test that was normal. And so at this point, you would do an angiography. This patient was sent home. All right, so cardiac MRI is also coming into fruition as a benefit. By the way, his angiogram was normal. So he didn't have any coronary artery disease. His echo was normal, his stress test was normal, his stress nuclear was normal. All of this was normal. And in the normal perspective, you'd say, well, why are we going to do anything further? Well, because obviously he had an abnormality of near syncope that was affiliated with the self-limiting ventricular tachycardia and an abnormal EKG. And we need to understand the etiology for this. So now we're talking about an infiltrative disease process. And the only way that we can identify that is with cardiac MRI. My main point to present this lecture to you is the sensitivity and specificity of different tests with different conditions. And just because you have all the negative tests with those first five, other than the EKG, shouldn't prohibit you from moving forward if you're concerned about the clinical condition of the patient, the symptoms and the physical examination and the EKG. So in this case, the EKG was abnormal. That means we have to continue to find out what the problem is. And that's the whole point of risk stratifying tests. Not, there's no one test that's 100% diagnostic. Now, in this particular case, cardiac MRI is helpful because it was positive for late gadolinium limb enhancement in the septum. And the EKG was in. We did an electrophysiology test, and he had inducible ventricular tachycardia. You can see this in this particular electrogram. You may get an EP electrogram. It's usually going to demonstrate a HIS and a V, just because that's something you can measure, and it's something that you as internists should know about in terms of an anatomy. In this particular case, you see the HIS monitor shows A waves that are dissociated. There's up on the top four surface electrocardiograms, which are definitely surface because they're wide. And then you see the intracardiac electrograms across the His bundle and then the right ventricular apex. And you can see that there's more Vs than As, and there's V dissociation as diagnostic of ventricular tachycardia. We pace terminated this, which demonstrates that the mechanism for this is reentry. So when you can pace terminate an arrhythmia, you have reentry. That's going to potentially be on a test. Reentry versus automaticity for arrhythmias could be a matching section. So this person has an arrhythmic cardiomyopathy, is normal left ventricle function. He's focal, it's diastolic dysfunction, it's ARVC, it could be sarcoidosis, it could be inherited, right? Because his father died suddenly at age 55, very close to his age. And it could be vasculitic or myocardial inflammatory disease. So the subject should be informed and counseled in advance of any sampling. This patient should undergo genetic testing because of his father's sudden cardiac death and his presentation arrhythmically. And so this is another form of testing that's actually coming out as a risk factor. Just a few points about genetic testing. It's going to be difficult to put this on a board examination other than as a further risk stratifying process for the patient, mainly because just because you have a genetic disorder doesn't mean you're going to phenotypically express it. And so just getting a genetic test alone is not enough to guide your familial family practice and interventions for this family. So you need a counselor to come in and detail that in some degree so that the patient has an understanding of what's going on. Now, one aspect to this is to get the prodrome, the first presenter in the family, to get the genetic test so you have an understanding if you even need to genetic test anybody else. So the only reason to genetic test anybody else is if the prodrome's positive for a genetic test that's actually available at this time. And there's more coming out every single day, so it's a very difficult thing to test on specific genetic tests. But it is something that's, from an ethical standpoint and an availability standpoint, a risk stratifier for other family members. And you're going to find it more in the cardiomyopathies that I described earlier than in this particular patient. And indeed, this patient did undergo genetic testing, but it was negative. So then that obviates the need to test any of his family. So then you're only relying on phenotypic expressive tests such as MRI. And so that would be a condition that you would take into account probably after evaluating an EKG in his family members. I put that in there for you to review just as a quick review, and you can read it. So the goals of imaging cardiomyopathy. So exclude ischemic etiology. Remember I told you the two most common causes for cardiomyopathy are CAD and hypertension. Determine underlying etiology, risk stratification, prediction of need and response to device therapy. These are the main reasons to undergo testing of the cardiomyopathy, and you can see that what I've put here is the appropriate use criteria, which is being used on every type of modality. But I think at this stage, cardiac MRI is very ripe for testing. It wasn't so 4 or 5 years ago, but now it is somewhat in the mainstream. And so you look at it for cardiomyopathies, you look at it for evaluation of LV function, and when you find the cardiomyopathies and you have a much more defined understanding of the fibrotic nature of it, and believe me, there's a lot of myocarditis out there that's undiagnosed, and you probably find it with some mild EKG findings, and then you would be able to slam dunk it on a CMR. And I think that those are really common things that are by the wayside. It puts people at risk for sudden cardiac death, and we are the only ones that can actually find it because they've gone through their symptom complex, so it's relatively viral, and then they come back. And when you talk to somebody, you can't, when you see an MRI like this, you can't go back and identify a particular time when this happened. It's very difficult. So the MRI is really a functional risk stratifier that's coming into fruition. It's not at every hospital yet, but it has the ability to allow you to understand three-dimensional cardiovascular function, as well as fibrosis, as well as infiltration, as well as ejection fraction, and now ischemia. So what is myocardial perfusion imaging? It's nuclear cardiology procedures, and they've overtaken non-cardiology procedures in terms of volume, at least in the previous decade. They have fallen to a lesser utilization, namely because of CT scanning for angiography, as well as for MRI, to give you much better detail than the nuclear scans. When you look at images, you can see that it gives you three specific views, a short axis view, a long axis, and then a horizontal view. And this is how the nuclear scans are presented. I doubt they're going to give you anything but a result. They're not going to have you read an image of this on the examination. But I just show this to you so you have an understanding of what they're actually looking at. And when you look at, you know, so the reason that for you to look at this and say, okay, what is this, and to understand it is, you can look at this and you can say, that's a really subjective way of reading things. There's not a whole lot of objectivity because the detail anatomically is pixelated in a color differentiation rather than really true anatomy. So think about that as we move through these tests. If you look at the special situations with nuclear testing, if your patient has a resting EKG that impairs diagnostic interpretation, left bundle branch block is the number one. LV hypertrophy of strain pattern will adjust and will also affect your exercise nuclear type testing, as well as digitalis effect. Concomitant stress imaging with TTE or nuclear imaging is usually appropriate. It's very rare that you're just going to do a stress test. Farm stressing for nuclear, which is the more common type being done today in the nuclear labs, is suggested for left bundle branch block. All right, so here's the case, and you can read the case at your leisure. This is a typical thing that you would get presented, maybe not the imaging, but definitely the history. It's a typical patient, middle-aged, with diabetes and a one-month history of angina, so don't de novo angina. You may even make the case that this is not a patient that you would necessarily do any type of non-invasive imaging on. You'd probably go right to invasive action because it's de novo, and the patient has risk factors. You know, it's a male, it's 48, diabetic with angina. If you look at it, they have other risk factors, hypertension, hyperlipidemia. But I would tell you that the majority of patients in the clinical venue go for this test, and they usually go for a nuclear test, and it's usually unremarkable. So the left ventricular ejection fraction is normal here, and the imaging doesn't really give you a purview that there's any ischemia across the anterior wall. And yet the angiogram is going to be abnormal, as you see on the right. So what's that tell you? It tells you that this test is a false negative, which is not uncommon. So how do we get away from false negative tests and get into more specificity? And when you look at this, you're looking at the assessment of left ventricular and right ventricular function with the cardiac MRI. Now you're seeing things in the same views that I showed you the nuclear test, but it's more anatomically based, and even somebody that's not very trained can actually look at it and have a general understanding of what is right and left ventricle and how it functions. And one thing that you can see, if they show you echoes on the examination or any imaging tests of the heart, there's going to be a definitive way that you can tell the left ventricle from the right ventricle is the left ventricle looks oval on any imaging, and the right ventricle looks triangular. It's more like a bellow, whereas the left ventricle is more like a wringing out of a rag. And so it's more tortuous, there's more torque force on a left ventricle, whereas the right ventricle is like a bellow. So if you look at it from that perspective, it's easy to identify. And they might give you that on a congenital question of transposition or something like that. So CMR gives you left ventricular ejection fraction, it gives you left ventricular end-diastolic volume, and it's comparable now to MUGA scans and 2D echo, but it's three-dimensional, and it's more anatomically detailed, and you can also look for assessment of viability. So you can look at whether or not there's enhancement and or perfusion utilizing the CMR, and you can get very, very good anatomic detail across it, and it can be very, very correlative to the anatomy of somebody's hypertrophic scar. So when you look at this, you can see infarct and scar. You can see infiltrated fibrosis from myocarditis, and you can have a much better defined understanding of the anatomy. And if you look at the prognostic value of regadenoscene stress cardiac MRI versus nuclear imaging, you can see that there's a much better negative range. So it's not as common to have a false negative in these modalities. So if you just look at stress testing and imaging across different genders, I think this slide is very important to understand. First of all, if you have chest pain, and regardless of whether or not you're male or female over age 60, the pretest evaluation is very high that it's going to be abnormal and that you're going to have a much more clinically better management plan after having this test, as opposed to females under age 50 that have no real chest pain and maybe atypical chest pain, and they're intermediate to low. And then if they're asymptomatic, it's very low, that it's going to yield any benefit for you. In other words, you're not going to be able to find a whole lot out about this as a risk stratifier. And so it's a useless test, in other words. So it's done every day, but it's not a very predictive test of anything. So in other words, these are the kinds of patients that have a stress test this week and have an MI next week. And so you need to take into account the fact that there's other risk factors like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes, as markers of acute coronary events that you can do a lot more with than a stress test is going to help you decide. If you're having angina pain and it's de novo or it's accelerating, you should go for an angiogram and not get a stress test. After you get the angiogram, you may want to figure out whether or not there's some physiologic basis to intervene. That's completely different. So when you look at comparison of tests for diagnosis of coronary artery disease, you see that adding imaging increases the predictive accuracy, but that nowhere across this board is there any strategy that's 88% predictive or greater than 88%. And so that means that there's 12% of the patients that you're going to be testing that get no value out of the test at all. And these are things that I think should be tested on the boards, you know, where you definitely, you don't want to, so in other words, you don't want a 50-year-old female coming to your office with shortness of breath who has a negative stress test that you just stop doing everything and say, here, take an inhaler. That's not going to do her any good, and she's going to present later with the frothy sputum because she blew out her mitral valve. And so EKGs can miss MIs as much as anything. Stress echo is also capable, and it's good. It's two-dimensional as opposed to three-dimensional, and it can be used in left bundle branch block. So it does not disqualify the patient, but you should understand that you're not going to rely heavily on the septal, anterior septal walls, because they are influenced. But the reason why it's beneficial is because in the pretest you're seeing that it's already influenced, and then with the stress, you can still see it. And so the enhancement is the key to the entire test, or the stability of the pretest finding. Just in closing, perioperative stress testing is pretty much not needed. I think Dr. Bender talked about it in detail. If you're going to do it, it's usually going to be pharmacologic stress testing. And if you're going to do the test, you should only do it on patients where you may be able to have an option that's non-surgical to treat the condition. In other words, if you find an abnormality on the stress test, that's going to skew your entire plan. And if it's in a patient that needs the surgery and there's no other option, there's really no point in doing it, and you should manage the patient expectantly and just assume that they're going to have hypertension, atrial arrhythmias, possibly ventricular arrhythmias, and within the first 48 hours, a myocardial infarction. That's just part and parcel of the whole thing. the two main groups that really suffer with surgery and induction of anesthesia are left main patients and aortic stenosis severe patients. Outside of that, you're pretty good to go, and you just have to manage the patient acutely as you would. And a discussion with the anesthesiologist about how to manage blood pressure and acute transient arrhythmia is probably the best thing to do. But you can see that coronary revascularization is, according to the guidelines, based on an abnormal test. So if you don't do the test, it's very rare that you get this to sort of skew your management plans. But if you do it and you have to have an angiogram and it shows left main disease, then you're going to have to have a discussion and maybe choose other modalities to treat a cancer or treat an abdominal problem. And this really gets into this non-invasive treatment or palliation as an alternative strategy. The key is just when you order a test, just be ready, because there's false positives, false negatives, and it can really, as much as it helps your management, you should already understand what you're going to do before you order the test, whether it's positive or negative. Have that in your mind before you order the test, because you don't know what the result's going to be, and it could be either way. It could be false, or it could be a positive test, a false positive, a false negative test, or a false negative. What do you notice about this screen for recommendations of supplemental preoperative evaluation? There is no class 1 indication. There is class 3 indications, and that's probably what you'll be tested on in the examination. And so in that capacity, 12-lead ECG, I don't think there's a lot to go wrong with that. They're talking about asymptomatic low-risk surgical patients, meaning those patients that have greater than 4 mets of activity in a day, you don't have to do a screening EKG on them all the time. Routine preoperative evaluation of LV function is not recommended in the same group. And routine screening with non-invasive stress tests is not useful for low-risk non-cardiac surgery. And routine screening with non-invasive stress tests is not useful for low-risk non-cardiac surgery. So there you go. So it's not used as much. We used to get, when I was training, we got a stress test on every patient before they went for surgery, but now it's not necessary. It only creates a situation where you don't get the necessary surgery. Okay, so perioperative percutaneous coronary intervention before a non-cardiac surgery should be limited to left main disease who can't get bypass surgery without undue risk, and patients with unstable CAD who are candidates for emergent or urgent revascularization. So in other words, say a patient comes and they're pregnant and they're in their third trimester and they may be having labor pains, but they're having an acute MI because of a dissected LAD. Now's the time to go in and open up that LAD before you deliver the baby. So you do the LAD, you put a balloon pump in, you deliver the baby, and then you go from there. That's the message here. And then coronary artery revascularization prophylaxis showed no difference in perioperative or long-term cardiac outcomes. So you shouldn't just do, you know, because there's a significant stenosis there, and a PCI or some sort of stent placement, perioperatively thinking that that's going to help the patient. That's not going to do it. Now, left main disease and severe AS aside, those are the two you really got to look for clinically in patients. And that's just based on risk factors. So I put some references back on here. I think the most important one that's easiest for you to reference is that webpage, riskcalculatorfacs.org. That's going to be on the test. I'll stop there. Thank you.